This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silko, narrated by Pete Bradbury and directed by Natanya Johnson. This book is copyrighted 1977 by Leslie Marmon Silko. This recording is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books. Leslie Marmon Silko was born in Albuquerque in 1948 of mixed ancestry, Laguna Pueblo, Mexican, and white. She grew up in the Laguna Pueblo Reservation, where she still lives today. A prominent Native American literary figure, she was the recipient of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Award in 1981. In her novel Ceremony, she describes the experiences of a young Indian soldier returning from a horrific experience in World War II who deals with his trauma by turning to his Indian past, its traditions, its beliefs about witchcraft and evil, and to the ancient stories of his people. And now, Ceremony.
Tsi'iti Nako, Thought Woman, is sitting in her room, and whatever she thinks about appears. She thought of her sisters Nautsi'i'i and Iktsi'i'i, and together they created the universe, this world, and the four worlds below. Thought Woman, the spider, named things, and as she named them, they appeared. She is sitting in her room thinking of a story now. I'm telling you the story, she is thinking. Ceremony. I will tell you something about stories, he said. They aren't just entertainment. Don't be fooled. They are all we have, you see. All we have to fight off illness and death. You don't have anything if you don't have the stories. Their evil is mighty, but it can't stand up to our stories. So they try to destroy the stories, let the stories be confused or forgotten. They would like that. They would be happy, because we would be defenseless then. He rubbed his belly. I keep them here, he said. Here. Put your hand on it. See? It is moving. There is life here, for the people. And in the belly of this story, the rituals and the ceremony are still growing. What she said. The only cure I know is a good ceremony. That's what she said. Sunrise. Teo didn't sleep well that night. He tossed in the old iron bed, and the coiled springs kept squeaking even after he lay still again, calling up humid dreams of black night and loud voices rolling him over and over again like debris caught in a flood. Tonight the singing had come first, squeaking out of the iron bed, a man singing in Spanish, the melody of a familiar love song. Two words again and again. Y volveré. Sometimes the Japanese voices came first, angry and loud, pushing the song far away. And then he could hear the shift in his dreaming, like a slight afternoon wind changing its direction, coming less and less from the south, moving into the west. And the voices would become Laguna voices. And he could hear Uncle Josiah calling to him. Josiah bringing him the fever medicine when he had been sick a long time ago. But before Josiah could come, the fever voices would drift and whirl and emerge again. Japanese soldiers shouting orders to him, suffocating damp voices that drifted out in the jungle steam. And he heard the women's voices then. They faded in and out until he was frantic, because he thought the Laguna words were his mother's. But when he was about to make out the meaning of the words, the voice suddenly broke into a language he couldn't understand. And it was then that all the voices were drowned by the music. Loud, loud music from a big jukebox, its flashing red and blue lights pulling the darkness closer. He lay there early in the morning and watched the high, small window above the bed. Dark gray gradually became lighter until it cast a white square on the opposite wall at dawn. He watched the room grow brighter then, as the square of light grew steadily warmer, more yellow with the climbing sun. He hadn't been able to sleep for a long time, for as long as all things had become tied together like colts in single file when he and Josiah had taken them to the mountain, with the halter rope of one colt tied to the tail of the colt ahead of it, and the lead colt's rope tied to the wide horn on Josiah's Mexican saddle. He could still see them now, the creamy sorrel, the bright red bay, and the gray roan, their slick summer coats reflecting the sunlight as it came up from behind the yellow mesas, shining on them, strung out behind Josiah's horse like an old-time pack train. He could get no rest as long as the memories were tangled with the present, tangled up like colored threads from old Grandma's wicker sewing basket when he was a child, and he had carried them outside to play, and they had spilled out of his arms into the summer weeds and rolled away in all directions, and then he had hurried to pick them up before Auntie found them. He could feel it inside his skull, the tension of little threads being pulled, and how it was with tangled things, things tied together. And as he tried to pull them apart and rewind them into their places, they snagged and tangled even more. So Teo had to sweat through those nights when thoughts became entangled. He had to sweat to think of something that wasn't unraveled or tied in knots to the past, something that existed by itself, standing alone like a deer. And if he could hold that image of the deer in his mind long enough, his stomach might shiver less and let him sleep for a while. It worked as long as the deer was alone, as long as he could keep it a gray buck on an unrecognized hill. But if he didn't hold it tight, it would spin away from him and become the deer he and Rocky had hunted. That memory would unwind into the last day when they had sat together, oiling their rifles in the jungle of some nameless Pacific island. While they used up the last of the oil in Rocky's pack, they talked about the deer that Rocky had hunted, and the corporal next to them shook his head and kept saying he had dreamed the Japs would get them that day. The humid air turned into sweat that had run down the corporal's face while he repeated his dream to them. That was the first time Teo had realized that the man's skin wasn't much different from his own. The skin. He saw the skin of the corpses again and again, in ditches on either side of the long muddy road, skin that was stretched shiny and dark over bloated hands. Even white men were darker after death. There was no difference when they were swollen and covered with flies. That had become the worst thing for Teo. They looked too familiar, even when they were alive. When the sergeant told them to kill all the Japanese soldiers lined up in front of the cave with their hands on their heads, Teo couldn't pull the trigger. The fever made him shiver, and the sweat was stinging his eyes, and he couldn't see clearly. In that instant, he saw Josiah standing there. The face was dark from the sun, and the eyes were squinting as though he were about to smile at Teo. So Teo stood there, stiff with nausea, while they fired at the soldiers and he watched his uncle fall. And he knew it was Josiah. And even after Rocky started shaking him by the shoulders and telling him to stop crying, it was still Josiah lying there. They forced medicine into Teo's mouth, and Rocky pushed him toward the corpses and told him to look, look past the blood that was already dark like the jungle mud, with only flecks of bright red still shimmering in it. Rocky made him look at the corpse and said, "Teo, this is a Jap. This is a Jap uniform." And then he rolled the body over with his boot and said, "Look, Teo, look at the face." And that was when Teo started screaming, because it wasn't a Jap, it was Josiah, eyes shrinking back into the skull, and all their shining black light glazed over by death. The sergeant had called for a medic, and somebody rolled up Teo's sleeve. They told him to sleep, and the next day they all acted as though nothing had happened. They called it battle fatigue, and they said hallucinations were common with malarial fever. Rocky had reasoned it out with him. It was impossible for the dead man to be Josiah, because Josiah was an old Laguna man, thousands of miles from the Philippine jungles and Japanese armies. "He's probably up on some mesa right now, chopping wood," Rocky said. He smiled and took Teo's shoulders. "Hey, I know you're homesick, but Teo was supposed to be here. This is what we're supposed to do." Teo nodded, slapped at the insect mechanically, and staring straight ahead, past the smothering dampness of the green jungle leaves. He examined the facts and logic again and again, the way Rocky had explained it to him. The facts made what he had seen an impossibility. He felt the shivering then. It began at the tips of his fingers and pulsed into his arms. He shivered because all the facts, all the reasons, made no difference anymore. He could hear Rocky's words, and he could follow the logic of what Rocky said. But he couldn't feel anything except the swelling in his belly, a great swollen grief that was pushing into his throat. He had to keep busy. He had to keep moving so that the sinews connected behind his eyes didn't slip loose and spin his eyes to the interior of his skull where the scenes waited for him. He got out of the bed quickly while he could still see the square of yellow sunshine on the wall opposite the bed, and he pulled on his jeans and the scuffed brown boots he had worn before the war, and the red plaid western shirt old Grandma gave him the day he had come home after the war. The air outside was still cool. It smelled like night dampness, faintly of rain. He washed his face in the steel-cold water of the iron trough by the windmill. The yellow-striped cat purred and wrapped herself around his legs while he combed his hair. She ran ahead of him to the goat pen and shoved her head under his left arm when he knelt down to milk the black goat. He poured milk for her in the lid of an old enamel coffee pot, and then he opened the pen and let them run, greedy for the tender green shoots of tumbleweeds pushing through the sand. The kid was almost too big to nurse anymore, and it knelt by the doe and hunched down to reach the tits, butting her to make the milk come faster, wiggling its tail violently until the nanny jumped away and turned on the kid, butting it away from her. The process of weaning had gone on like this for weeks, but the nanny was more intent on weeds than the lesson, and when Tail left them, the kid goat was back at the tits, a little more careful this time. The sun was climbing then, and it looked small in that empty morning sky. He knew he should eat, but he wasn't hungry anymore. He sat down in the kitchen, at the small square table, with the remains of a white candle melted to a nub on the lid of a coffee can. He wondered how long the candle had been there. He wondered if Josiah had been the one to light it last. He thought he would cry then, thinking of Josiah, and how he had been here and touched all these things, sat in his chair. So he jerked his head away from the candle and looked at the soot around the base of the coffee pot. He wouldn't waste firewood to heat up yesterday's coffee, or maybe it was day before yesterday's coffee. He had lost track of the days there. The drought years had returned again, as they had after the First World War and in the '20s, when he was a child, and they had to haul water to the sheep in big wooden barrels in the old wagon. The windmill near the sheep camp had gone dry, so the gray mules pulled the wagon from the springs, moving slowly so that the water wouldn't splash over the rims. He sat close to his uncle then, on the wagon seat, above the bony gray rumps of the mules. After they had dumped water for the sheep, they went to burn the spines from the cholla and the prickly pear. They stood back by the wagon and watched the cows walk up to the cactus cautiously, sneezing at the smoldering ashes. The cows were patient while the scorched green pulp cooled, and then they brought out their wide, spotted tongues and ate those strange remains because the hills were barren those years, and only the cactus could grow. Now there was no wagon nor wooden barrels. One of the gray mules had eaten a poison weed near a coma, and the other one was blind. It stayed close to the windmill at the ranch, grazing on the yellow rice grass that grew in the blow sand. It walked a skinny trail, winding in blind circles from the grass to the water trough, where it dipped its mouth in the water and let the water dribble out again, rinsing its mouth 4 or 5 times a day to make sure the water was still there. The dry air shrank the wooden staves of the barrels. They pulled loose, and now the rusty steel hoops were scattered on the ground behind the corral and the crazy patterns of some flashy Kiowa hoop dancer at the gallop ceremonials, throwing his hoops along the ground where he would hook and flip them into the air again, and they would skim over his head and shoulders down to his dancing feet like magic. Tao stepped inside one that was half buried in the reddish blow sand. He hooked an edge with the toe of his boot, and then he let it slip into the sand again. The wind had blown since late February, and it didn't stop after April. They said it had been that way for the past 6 years while he was gone. And all this time they had watched the sky expectantly for the rain clouds to come. Now it was late May, and when Tao went to the outhouse, he left the door open wide, facing the dry, empty hills and the light blue sky. He watched the sky over the distant Black Mountains the way Josiah had many years before, because sometimes when the rain finally came, it was from the southwest. Jungle rain had no beginning or end. It grew like foliage from the sky, branching and arching to the earth, sometimes in solid thickets entangling the islands, and other times in tendrils of blue mist curling out of coastal clouds. The jungle breathed an eternal green that fevered men until they dripped sweat the way rubbery jungle leaves drip the monsoon rain. It was there that Teo began to understand what Josiah had said. Nothing was all good or all bad either. It all depended. Jungle rain lay suspended in the air, choking their lungs as they marched. It soaked into their boots until the skin on their toes peeled away dead and wounds turned green. This wasn't the rain he and Josiah had prayed for. This wasn't the green foliage they sought out in sandy canyons as a sign of a spring. When Teo prayed on the long muddy road to the prison camp, it was for dry air, dry as 100 years squeezed out of yellow sand, air to dry out the oozing wounds of Rocky's leg, to let the torn flesh and broken bones breathe, to clear the sweat that filled Rocky's eyes. It was that rain which filled the tire ruts and made the mud so deep that the corporal began to slip and fall with his end of the muddy blanket that held Rocky. Teo hated this unending rain, as if it were the jungle green rain and not the miles of marching or the Japanese grenade that was killing Rocky. He would blame the rain if the Japs saw how the corporal staggered. If they saw how weak Rocky had become and came to crush his head with the butt of a rifle, then it would be the rain and the green all around that killed him. Teo talked to the corporal almost incessantly, walking behind him with his end of the blanket stretcher, telling him that it wasn't much farther now and all downhill from there. He made a story for all of them, a story to give them strength. The words of the story poured out of his mouth as if they had substance, pebbles and stone extending to hold the corporal up, to keep his knees from buckling, to keep his hands from letting go of the blanket. The sound of the rain got louder, pounding on the leaves, splashing into the ruts. It splattered on his head, and the sound echoed inside his skull. It streamed down his face and neck like jungle flies with crawling feet. He wanted to turn loose the blanket to wipe the rain away. He wanted to let go for only a moment. But as long as the corporal was still standing, still moving, they had to keep going. Then, from somewhere, within the sound of the rain falling, he could hear it approaching like a summer flash flood, the rumble still faint and distant, floodwater boiling down a narrow canyon. He could smell the foaming floodwater, stagnant and ripe with the rotting debris it carried past each village, sucking up their sewage, their waste, the dead animals. He tried to hold it back, but the wind swept down from the green coastal mountains, whipping the rain into gray waves that blinded him. The corporal fell, jerking the ends of the blanket from his hands, and he felt Rocky's foot brush past his own leg. He slid to his knees, trying to find the ends of the blanket again, and he started repeating, "God damn! God damn!" It flooded out of the last warm core in his chest and echoed inside his head. He damned the rain until the words were a chant, and he sang it while he crawled through the mud to find the corporal and get him up before the Japanese saw them. He wanted the words to make a cloudless blue sky, pale with a summer sun pressing across wide and empty horizons. The words gathered inside him and gave him strength. He pulled on the corporal's arm. He lifted him to his knees, and all the time he could hear his own voice praying against the rain. It was summertime, and Iktoaktoa, reed woman, was always taking a bath. She spent all day long sitting in the river, splashing down the summer rain. But her sister, corn woman, worked hard all day, sweating in the sun, getting sore hands in the cornfield. Corn woman got tired of that. She got angry. She scolded her sister for bathing all day long. Iktoaktoa, reed woman, went away then. She went back to the original place down below. And there was no more rain then. Everything dried up. all the plants, the corn, the beans. They all dried up and started blowing away in the wind. The people and the animals were thirsty. They were starving. So he had prayed the rain away, and for the sixth year it was dry. The grass turned yellow and it didn't grow. Wherever he looked, Teo could see the consequences of his praying. The gray mule grew gaunt, and the goat and kid had to wander farther and farther each day to find weeds or dry shrubs to eat. In the evenings they waited for him, chewing their cuds by the shed door, and the mule stood by the gate with blind marble eyes. He threw them a little dusty hay and sprinkled some cracked corn over it. The nanny crowded the kid away from the corn. The mule whinnied and leaned against the sagging gate. Teo reached into the coffee can and he held some corn under the quivering lips. When the corn was gone, the mule licked for the salt taste on his hand. The tongue was rough and wet, but it was also warm and precise across his fingers. Teo looked at the long white hairs growing out of the lips like antennas, and he got the choking in his throat again. And he cried for all of them, and for what he had done. For a long time, he had been white smoke. He didn't realize that until he left the hospital, because white smoke had no consciousness of itself. It faded into the white world of their bedsheets and walls. It was sucked away by the words of doctors who tried to talk to the invisible scattered smoke. He had seen outlines of gray steel tables, outlines of the food they pushed into his mouth, which was only an outline too, like all the outlines he saw. They saw his outline, but they didn't realize it was hollow inside. He walked down floors that smelled of old wax and disinfectant, watching the outlines of his feet. As he walked, the days and seasons disappeared into a twilight at the corner of his eyes. A twilight he could catch only with a sudden motion, jerking his head to one side for a glimpse of green leaves pressed against the bars in the window. He inhabited a gray winter fog on a distant elk mountain where hunters are lost indefinitely, and their own bones mark the boundaries. He stood outside the train depot in Los Angeles and felt the sunshine. He saw palm trees, the edges of their branches turning yellow, dead gray fronds scaling off, scattered over the ground. And at that moment, his body had density again, and the world was visible, and he realized why he was there, and he remembered Rocky, and he started to cry. The red Spanish tile on the depot roof got blurry, but he didn't move or wipe away the tears because it had been a long time since he had cried for anyone. The smoke had been dense. Visions and memories of the past didn't penetrate there, and he had drifted in colors of smoke, where there was no pain, only pale, pale gray of the north wall by his bed. Their medicine drained memory out of his thin arms and replaced it with a twilight cloud behind his eyes. It wasn't possible to cry on the remote and foggy mountain. If they hadn't dressed him and led him to the car, he would still be there, drifting along the north wall, invisible in the gray twilight. The new doctor asked him if he had ever been visible, and Teo spoke to him softly and said that he was sorry, but nobody was allowed to speak to an invisible one. But the new doctor persisted. He came each day, and his questions dissolved the edges of the fog, and his voice sounded louder every time he came. The sun was dissolving the fog, and one day Teo heard a voice answering the doctor. The voice was saying, "He can't talk to you. He's invisible. His words are formed with an invisible tongue. They have no sound." He reached into his mouth and felt his own tongue. It was dry and dead, the carcass of a tiny rodent. "It's easy to remain invisible here, isn't it, Teo?" "It was until you came. It was all white. All the color of the smoke, the fog. I'm sending you home, Teo. Tomorrow you'll go on the train." "He can't go. He cries all the time. Sometimes he vomits when he cries." Why does he cry, Teo? He cries because they're dead and everything is dying. He could see the doctor clearly then, the dark, thick hair growing on the backs of the doctor's hands as they reached out at him. Go ahead, Teo. You can cry. He wanted to scream at the doctor then, but the words choked him, and he coughed up his own tears and tasted their salt in his mouth. He smelled the disinfectant then, the urine and the vomit, and he gagged. He raised his head from the sink in the corner of the room. He gripped both sides, and he looked up at the doctor. God damn you, he said softly. Look what you've done. There was a cardboard name tag on the handle of the suitcase he carried. He could feel it with the tips of his fingers. His name was on the tag, and his serial number, too. It had been a long time since he had thought about having a name. The man at the ticket window told him it would be 25 minutes before the train left on track 4. He pointed out the big doors to the tracks and told Teo he could wait out there. Teo felt weak, and the longer he walked, the more his legs felt as though they might become invisible again. Then the top part of his body would topple, and when his head was level with the ground, he would be lost in smoke again, in the fog again. He breathed the air outside the doors, and it smelled like trains, diesel oil, and creosote ties under the steel track. He leaned against the depot wall then. He was sweating, and sounds were becoming outlines again, vague and hollow in his ears, and he knew he was going to become invisible right there. It was too late to ask for help, and he waited to die the way smoke dies, drifting away in currents of air, twisting in thin swirls, fading until it exists no more. His last thought was how generous they had become, sending him to the L.A. depot alone, finally allowing him to die. He lay on the concrete listening to the voices that surrounded him, voices that were either soft or distant. They spoke to him in English, and when he didn't answer, there was a discussion, and he heard the Japanese words vividly. He wasn't sure where he was anymore, maybe back in the jungles again. He felt a sick sweat shiver over him like the shadow of the angel Auntie talked about. He fought to come to the surface, and he expected a rifle barrel to be shoved into his face when he opened his eyes. It was all worse than he had ever dreamed. To have drifted all those months in white smoke, only to wake up again in a prison camp. But he didn't want to be invisible when he died, so he pulled himself loose one last time. The Japanese women were holding small children by the hands, and they were surrounded by bundles and suitcases. One of them was standing over him. "Are you sick?" she asked. He tried to answer her, but his throat made a coughing, gagging sound. He looked at her and tried to focus in on the others. "We called for help," she said, bending over slightly, the hem of her flower print dress swaying below her knees. A white man in a train uniform came. He looked at Teo, and then he looked at the women and children. "What happened to him?" They shook their heads, and the woman said, "We saw him fall down as we were coming from our train." She moved away then, back to the group. She reached down and picked up a shopping bag in each hand. She looked at Teo one more time. He raised himself up on one arm and watched them go. He felt the current of air from the movement of their skirts and feet and shopping bags. A child stared back at him, holding a hand, but walking twisted around so that he could see Teo. The little boy was wearing an army hat that was too big for him, and when he saw Teo looking, he smiled. Then the child disappeared through the wide depot doors. The depot man helped him get up. He checked the tag on the suitcase. "Should I call the Veterans Hospital?" Teo shook his head. He was beginning to shiver all over. "Those people," he said, pointing in the direction the women and children had gone. "I thought they locked them up." "Oh, that was some years back, right after Pearl Harbor, but now they turn them all loose again. Sent them home. I don't guess you could keep up with news very well in the hospital."
"No."
His voice sounded faint to him.
"You gonna be all right now?"
He nodded and looked down the tracks. The depot man glanced at a gold pocket watch and walked away. The swelling was pushing against his throat, and he leaned against the brick wall and vomited into the big garbage can. The smell of his own vomit and the rotting garbage filled his head, and he retched until his stomach heaved in frantic, dry spasms. He could still see the face of the little boy looking back at him, smiling, and he tried to vomit that image from his head because it was Rocky's smiling face from a long time before, when they were little kids together. He couldn't vomit anymore, and the little face was still there. So he cried at how the world had come undone, how thousands of miles, high ocean waves, and green jungles couldn't hold people in their place. Years and months had become weak, and people could push against them and wander back and forth in time. Maybe it had always been this way, and he was only seeing it for the first time. He sat on the bed with his back against the whitewashed wall and watched tiny crystals in the gypsum plaster as they glittered in the stream of sun from the window. He relaxed now that the goats were loose and the yellow cat had her milk. As the sun went higher and left the eastern sky, the square of sunshine on the wall grew larger and diffuse, and the bright yellow color of early morning was gone. The tiny crystals disappeared gradually, the way stars did at dawn. He knew at some point the sunlight on the wall would collapse into his thoughts like pale gray cobwebs, clinging to all things within him, and then his stomach would begin to convulse, and he would have to hold himself with both hands to try to hold back the tremor that grew inside. He went outside before it happened. The wind was practicing with small gusts of hot air that fluttered the leaves on the elm tree in the yard. The wind was warming up for the afternoon, and within a few hours the sky over the valley would be dense with red dust, and along the ground the wind would catch the waves of reddish sand and make them race across the dry red clay flats. The sky was hazy blue, and it looked far away and uncertain, but he could remember times when he and Rocky had climbed Bone Mesa, high above the valley southwest of Mesita, and he had felt that the sky was near, and that he could have touched it. He believed then that touching the sky had to do with where you were standing and how the clouds were that day. He had believed that on certain nights, when the moon rose full and wide as a corner of the sky, a person standing on the high sandstone cliff of that mesa could reach the moon. Distances and days existed in themselves then. They all had a story. They weren't barriers. If a person wanted to get to the moon, there was a way. It all depended on whether you knew the directions, exactly which way to go and what to do to get there. It depended on whether you knew the story of how others before you had gone. He had believed in the stories for a long time, until the teachers at Indian school taught him not to believe in that kind of nonsense. But they had been wrong. Josiah had been there in the jungle. He had come. Teo had watched him die. And he had done nothing to save him. Teo was sitting under the elm tree in the shade when Harley came riding up on the black burro. The burro was veering hard to the right, attempting to turn around and go in the opposite direction. Harley had the rope reins of the hackamore pulled all the way to the left, so that the burro's head was twisted around to the north, but the burro's legs and body moved sideways and drifted toward the east. Harley had to stop the burro every few hundred yards to correct their direction. He swatted the burro across the rump with a black horsehair quirt, the kind the old Mexicans used to braid. Dust from the burro's hide flew up around Harley. Harley saw Teo, and he tried to guide the burro to the tree, but it ignored the direction its head was aimed and walked sideways to the water trough and stopped. It stood there with its head up and a haughty look in its eyes. It waited until Harley was under the elm tree before it tasted the water. "That burro sure hates you, Harley." Harley laughed. "Nobody ever rode it before, except maybe some of the kids when my dad had it over at Casablanca." "Does it buck?" "It tries, but I think I'm too heavy for it. It doesn't jump very high." Harley was big and stocky. "My legs almost touch the ground anyway." Teo smiled again. His mouth felt stiff at the corners. Harley had been at Wake Island with Leroy Valdez and Emo. They had all come back with purple hearts, but it didn't seem as if the war had changed Harley. He was still a little fat, and he still made them laugh, joking and clowning.
"Hey, you don't happen to have a beer, do you?"
Teo shook his head. "There's some coffee on the stove."
"Nah, they say coffee's bad for you."
He laughed, and Teo smiled, because Harley didn't used to like beer at all. And maybe this was something that was different about him now, after the war. He drank a lot of beer now. But Teo could remember that time in the 8th grade when they had followed old Benny to see where he kept his wine. They watched him weave unsteadily through the salt bush down to the river willows and tamaracks growing along the river, all the while clutching his brown shopping bag close to his chest. They watched him take one last taste of the wine and push the cork in tight before he put it back in the bag, and carefully dig into the sandy riverbank, pushing white sand around the bag tenderly. They crouched with their chins on the sand and fallen willow leaves, peeking through the willows at him as he took a last look, as if to memorize the hiding place, and then walked crookedly up the hill away from the river. They got to their feet then, and when Benny disappeared over the hill, they ran to the hiding place, where the river flowed into a quiet pool. Rocky and Teo took the bottle of wine because there was only one bottle of beer.
"Okay for you, Harley," Rocky said. "Beer tastes awful." "Ah, you don't know. You never tasted any," Harley answered, trying to pry off the bottle cap with the short blade of his pocket knife.
"He's right, Harley. Josiah let us taste some one time." The wine was sweet and sticky, a little like cough syrup, but they drank it anyway because they had to if they wanted to get drunk. Harley finally got the beer open, and he was anxious to catch up with him, so he took a big swallow. He made a terrible face, wrinkling up his nose and rolling his eyes. He spent the rest of the afternoon spitting into the river, and they had to keep laughing because he kept saying, "Ugh, awful! It tastes like poison!" And then he would spit again and try to wipe the inside of his mouth on the sleeve of his shirt. Harley squatted down beside Teo. He traced little figures in the dirt by his feet. Teo closed his eyes and leaned back against the bottom of the tree. He flexed his feet out in front of him. They were quiet for a while. The wind was getting stronger. It made a whirling sound as it came around the southwest corner of the ranch house. A piece of old tin on the roof of the shed began to rattle. Teo felt as if he could sleep and maybe make up for the bad night before. There was a peaceful silence beneath the sounds of the wind. It was a silence with no trace of people. It was the silence of hard, dry clay and old juniper wood bleached white. But Harley was restless. Teo could feel it. Harley kept wiping away the outlines he drew in the dirt and starting over again, angry that he couldn't draw them the way he wanted them. Teo brought his knees up in front of him and concentrated on staying awake. Harley grinned at him.
"We got it easy, huh? All the livestock down in Montaño and nothing for us war heroes to do but lay around and sleep all day."
He reached over and poked Teo gently in the ribs when he said war heroes.
"I tried to go down there and help out, you know, when they first decided to move all the cattle and sheep down there. That was when you were still sick."
Harley shook his head.
"Really, man, I tried to help. I told my old man, hey, let me do it. I promise I won't mess up. Honest."
Harley was drawing an intricate pattern in the dirt, moving his forefinger without pausing then.
"But you know what happened, so they don't want me down there anymore. They told me I could look after the ranch out here, like you."
Harley looked up quickly to see Teo's face.
"You know what I mean, Teo," he said quickly. "You were really sick when you got back, and there isn't a damn thing wrong with me."
Teo nodded, but he was thinking about what happened while Harley was at the Montaño herding sheep, and he wasn't sure if Harley was right. The Montaño hadn't been as hard hit by the drought, so people with cattle and sheep moved them from areas of the reservation which had no grass or water to the Montaño, where they would keep them until the rains came, or for as long as the grass held out. Harley had gone to herd sheep for his family. They pitched a small square camp tent for him and brought him supplies and fresh things to eat every 2 or 3 days. He had a sheepdog to help him and a horse to ride all day long behind the grazing animals. His family was happy that he wanted to do this because it had taken Harley a while to settle down after he got home from the war. He had done a lot of drinking and raising hell with Emo and some of the other veterans. But after a week down there, Harley left the sheep grazing with only the sheepdog to watch them, and he rode the horse over to the highway. When they found the horse, it was still standing there, tied to the fence, only somebody had come along and stolen the saddle off it. Harley was gone, and a couple of days later he wrote from the jail in Las Lunas. By the time they got down to the Montaño, the sheep were scattered all over the hills. At the camp, they found the sheepdog dead, killed and torn to pieces by the wild animals that had killed 30 head of sheep. It was too bad about the dog and those sheep, Teo said. But Harley laughed. He shook his head and laughed very loudly. They weren't worth anything anyway. So skinny and tough, the coyotes had to kill half of them just to make one meal. He laughed again. Teo felt something stir along his spine. There was something in Harley's laugh he'd never heard before. Somehow Harley didn't seem to feel anything at all, and he masked it with smart talk and laughter. Harley stood up then, but Teo couldn't tell if it was because he didn't want to talk about the sheep, or if he was only getting stiff from squatting so long. I'd give just about anything for a cold beer, he said, looking around the place, at the house, the shed, and the corrals. They didn't leave you the truck, did they? I don't even see Josiah's wagon. It's under the shed by the corral, but there's nothing to pull it anyway. What about that gray mule? It's blind. Boy, they sure fixed you up good. I guess they don't want you wandering around either. Deo knew he was referring to the time at the Dixie Tavern when he had almost killed Emo. They were even now. Teo had asked about the sheep that were killed while Harley was gone, and Harley brought up the fight. I wanted to be alone. This is a good place for it. Yeah, well, not me. My old lady got out her Phillips 66 road map, and she looked at it all night until she found the place on the reservation that was the farthest away from any bars. I might be there right now, living on top of some mesa, if my father hadn't talked her into sending me to the ranch. Harley looked toward the southwest in the direction of the ranch. Shit. I think it is the farthest place anyway. Teo shrugged his shoulders. They were 25 or 30 miles from the bars on the other side of the reservation boundary line. People called it going up the line, and the bars were built one after the other alongside 66, beginning at Budville and extending 6 or 7 miles past San Fidel to the Whiting Brothers station near McCarty's. They can't stop me, so I don't know why they even try. Like the time they left me out there and they forgot to drain the gas out of the tractor. I hot-wired it and drove it all the way to San Fidel. I could have gotten back, too, but I ran out of gas near Paray. Harley laughed. His eyes were shining. It had been a victory for him. He had outsmarted all of them, his parents, his older brothers, everyone who worked to keep him away from beer and out of trouble. But this is the first time I've ridden a burro up the line, Teo, and, he paused to rub his ass, I think it'll be the last time. He walked over and kicked the sole of Teo's boot. Come on, get up. Don't die here under this tree. Let's go, man. Teo shook his head and threw his arms up in front of him, pretending to push the idea away. Hey, come on. We can set some kind of world's record. You know, longest donkey ride ever made for cold beer or something like that. An Indian world's record. When Harley talked like that, things that had happened, the dead sheep, the bar fight, even jail, all seemed very remote. Harley held out his hand, and Teo grabbed hold of it. He pulled himself to his feet. Teo went inside to get his wallet. When he came out, he saw Harley by the windmill. The wind had blown the brim of his hat against his forehead, but he had the gray mule, and he was pulling the bridle over the long gray ears. The mule was getting bony. Its hip bones looked sharp enough to push through the gray hide, the way bones tear through a carcass. Drought years shrank the hide tighter to the bones. Ewes dropped weak lambs, and cows had no calves in the spring. If it didn't start raining soon, all the livestock would have to be sold, like in the 30s, when buyers came from Albuquerque and Gallup and bought the cattle and sheep for almost nothing. But selling was better than watching them die when the grass was gone and there was no more cactus to burn for them. Nemo liked to point to the restless, dusty wind and the cloudless skies, to the bony horses chewing on the fence posts beside the highway. Nemo liked to say, "Look what's here for us. Look, here's the Indians' Mother Earth, old dried-up thing." Teo's anger made his hands shake. Nemo was wrong, all wrong. The wind whipped the mule's thin tail between its hind legs as Harley gave the reins to Teo. "Don't you have a saddle?" Harley asked. Teo shook his head. "How about an old saddle blanket? That mule's backbone will strike you in a vital place." They laughed, and Harley disappeared inside the old garage, and Teo could hear the noise of empty tubs, oil cans, and links of chain moved around. Harley came out shaking the dust from four gunny sacks, letting the wind pull at them like kites. He was grinning. Teo stood watching all this time, and except for smiling or laughing or speaking when Harley spoke to him, he wasn't doing anything. He was standing with the wind at his back, like that mule, and he felt he could stand there indefinitely, maybe forever, like a fence post or a tree. It took a great deal of energy to be a human being, and the more the wind blew and the sun moved southwest, the less energy Teo had. Harley was patient. He stood by the mule's head while Teo jumped belly first onto the mule's back and swung a leg over. Harley held the gunny sacks in place until Teo was on. Teo felt like a little kid. He felt eight again, and Josiah was boosting him onto the back of Sio's Pinto. Harley tied a lead rope on the mule's bridle, but the gray mule followed the burrow without any trouble, holding its head alert and its jackrabbit ears forward, nostrils flaring wide, testing for imagined dangers ahead. Teo didn't even bother to hold the reins. He knotted them the way Josiah had shown him when he was a little kid, so that the reins stayed together on the horse's neck. That way the horse couldn't jerk them from his hands, and he couldn't accidentally drop one. When he was so little that he couldn't reach the stirrups without climbing up on a fence or big rock, these details were important. The wind was blowing from the southwest, and it pushed against Teo's right shoulder. The noise of the wind was too loud for conversation, so Teo closed his eyes. He relaxed his thighs and let his feet dangle. He slouched forward over the mule's bony shoulders. He was tired of fighting off the dreams and the voices. He was tired of guarding himself against places and things which evoked the memories. He let himself go with the motion of the mule, swaying forward and backward with each stride, feeling the rise and fall of the mule's breathing under his legs. Above the wind, sometimes, he could hear Harley cussing out the burrow, telling it what he would do if he had a gun. The gusting winds had turned the sky dusty red. After 2 or 3 hours, Harley pulled his hat low over his eyes to keep it on, and he dozed off, with both arms out in front of him, holding the donkey's neck, propping him up. The burro must have been able to feel the change in Harley's grip on its neck when Harley dozed off, because it would begin to drift, gradually, from the right side of the road to the middle hump of sand and weeds, where it lowered its head quickly to reach a mouthful of weeds, but always kept moving, trying to keep Harley from noticing any change. It got to the left side of the road that way and walked along steadily, only long enough to fool Harley. Then the burro left the road entirely and completed the wide turn it had been engineering for almost half an hour. Teo watched the burro's deliberate moves, but its stubbornness made it predictable. In every 15 minutes, Harley jerked the burro's head sharply to the right, flicked its flanks with the horsehair quirt, then put them back on course again. So they traveled in wide arcs, moving gradually to the north. Teo thought about animals then, horses and mules, and the way they drifted with the wind. Josiah said that only humans had to endure anything, because only humans resisted what they saw outside themselves. Animals didn't resist, but they persisted because they became part of the wind. Inside, Teo. Inside the belly of the wind. So they moved with the snow, became part of the snowstorm which drifted up against the trees and fences. And when they died, frozen solid against a fence, with the snow drifted around their heads? Ah, Teo, Josiah said. The wind convinced them they were the ice. He wished Josiah were there. Not forever, like he had been wishing, but just long enough so Teo could tell him how he'd been feeling lately. How he'd almost been convinced he was brittle red clay, slipping away with the wind, a little more each day. The wind didn't blow as hard up there as it did on the clay flats. Harley stopped at the top of the hill and took a piss. The burrow chewed the dry tufts of grass as close to the gray shale as it could, and strained against the reins to reach another sparse clump of grass. But the mule stood alert, its milky, staring eyes wide open. They were the same, the mule and old grandma. She sitting in the corner of the room in the wintertime by the potbelly stove, or the summertime on an apple crate under the elm tree. She was as blind as the gray mule and just as persistent. She never hesitated to tell them that Rocky had promised to buy her a kerosene stove with his army pay, even after Teo came home from the hospital, and she knew the sound of Rocky's name made him cry.
"Don't cry, Teo. Don't cry. You know he wanted me to have it, and he didn't want you to cry."
So finally Auntie took $40 of the insurance money and sent Robert to town, and he brought home an old heater with an automatic thermostat, so that once it was lighted, all it needed was a barrel of fuel oil on the wooden rack outside. She ordered that kind because she didn't want to impose on any of them to look after her stove for her. Last year, on the coldest day of the winter, when San Jose Creek froze solid, and Auntie had gone to the store and old Grandma was all alone, the fire in the wood stove went out. This story always made Auntie stop whatever she was doing to say, "Mama, the coals were still warm when we got home." And old Grandma always pretended she didn't hear this, and she continued on about the things Rocky was going to do for her. They all mourned Rocky that way. My slipping, lapsing into the plans he had for college and for his football career. It didn't take Teo long to see the accident of time and space. Rocky was the one who was alive, buying Grandma her heater with the round dial on the front. Rocky was there in the college game scores on the sports page of the Albuquerque Journal. It was him, Teo, who had died. But somehow there had been a mistake with the corpses, and somehow his was still unburied. He started to cry, and when Harley looked back at him, he didn't wipe the tears away or pretend it was the dust and wind in his eyes. He was suddenly hollow. His fingers loosened and fell from the reins, slippery with sweat. The force of gravity seemed to surge up at him and pull him down. He hung with both arms to the mule's neck, but he was caught and being dragged away, rolling end over end in a flash flood in a big arroyo. After his hands slipped loose, his knees hit muddy ruts, and there was screaming and the sound of bone crushing, hollow white skull bone beaten to bayonet edges by the jungle rain. The floodwater was the color of the earth, of their skin, of the blood, his blood dried brown in the bandages. Harley helped him up. He brushed the sand and weeds from Teo's shirt and handed him his hat. He walked with him to the shade at the foot of the mesa. He hobbled the mule and tied a long rope to the burrow and let them graze on the thin bluish-green leaves of salt bushes growing at the entrance to the canyon. The sand felt cool. He squeezed it in both fists until it made little rivulets between his fingers. Harley sat down beside him and wiped his face on the sleeve of his shirt.
"Sunstroke. They always warn me about it, Teo. We should have stopped to rest sooner."
He looked at Teo closely.
"Are you okay?"
Teo nodded. He wanted to make a joke about himself, say something like, "Sunstroke, hell, the wind blew me off." But he didn't have energy to move his lips, to even form the words. Beyond the shade, everything shimmered in waves of heat and the wind. The cliffs across the little wash, the junipers growing among the big orange boulders, and the hazy pink sky were bright colors of a dream, and the longer Teo stared at them, the more he knew he was going to be sick. So he scratched a hole in the dry sand beside him, and when the glare of that light finally blinded him, he turned to his right side and vomited into the hole. When he got off the train at New Laguna, his legs were shaky, and the sleeves of his coat smelled like puke, although he had tried to rinse out the coat in the washroom sink on the train. He didn't want them to know how sick he had been, how all night he had leaned against the metal wall in the men's room, feeling the layers of muscle in his belly growing thinner, until the heaving was finally a ripple, and then a quiver. But Auntie stared at him the way she always had, reaching inside him with her eyes, calling up the past as if it were his future, too, as if things would always be the same for him. They both knew then she would keep him and take care of him all the months he would lie in a bed too weak to walk. This time she would keep him because he was all she had left. Many years ago she had taken him to conceal the shame of her younger sister. Now she stood over the bed and looked at him, and if he opened his eyes he knew he would see her probing for new shame, the anticipation of what she might find swelling inside her. What would it be this time? She remembered what that old fool Josiah had done. It wasn't any different from little sister and that white man. She had fiercely protected them from the gossip in the village, but she never let them forget what she had endured, all because of what they had done. That's why Teo knew she wouldn't send him away to a veterans hospital. He lay with his face in the pillow. She had always watched him more closely than Rocky, because Rocky had been her own son, and it had been her duty to raise him. Those who measured life by counting the crosses wouldn't count her sacrifices for Rocky the way they counted her sacrifices for her dead sister's half-breed child. When Rocky died, he became unassailable forever in his frame on top of her bureau. His death gave her new advantages with people. She had given so much. But advantages wear out. She needed a new struggle, another opportunity to show those who might gossip that she had still another unfortunate burden, which proved that, above all else, she was a Christian woman. That was how it would be. He figured it out the first afternoon he was home. At the end of the first week, she came into the room and pulled the sheets and blankets from all the beds, and he realized then she changed the beds as if Josiah and Rocky still slept there, tucking the dark wool blankets around the corners of the clean sheets, stuffing the pillows into starched white pillowcases she had ironed the day before. Finally, he heard her step close to his bed and lift the lid on the slop jar to see if it needed to be emptied. "How are you feeling?" He knew she wanted him to get out of bed while she changed the sheets. He sat up and swung his legs around to the floor. He got up unsteadily and moved toward the chair at the foot of the bed, but she took his arm and guided him to Rocky's bed. He wanted to pull out of her reach and go to the chair, but he was swaying with nausea. She pushed him into the bed and brought the slop jar. He pulled his knees up to his belly and writhed in the bed, fighting back the gagging. He felt the old mattress then, where all the years of Rocky's life had made contours and niches that Teo's bones didn't fit. Like plump satin-covered upholstery inside a coffin, molding itself around a corpse to hold it forever. He called for help and he drew his legs and arms stiffly to his sides and arched his back away from the mattress. His heart was pounding louder than his calls for help. He could hear old Grandma answering him, but Auntie didn't come. Finally, she came in from the porch. The sleeves of her dress were rolled up, her hands were damp and smelled like bleach. She pulled him from the bed, her face tight with anger. He pointed at the windows. "The light makes me vomit." She pulled down the shades, and he knew she was staring at him, almost as if she could see the outline of his lie in the dim light. But his advantage was the army doctors who told her and Robert that the cause of battle fatigue was a mystery, even to them. He felt better in the dark because he couldn't see the beds, where the blankets followed smooth concave outlines. He couldn't see the photographs and the frames in the bureau. In the dark, he could cry for all the dreams that Rocky had as he stared out of his graduation picture. He could cry for Josiah and the spotted cattle, all scattered now, all lost, sucked away in the dissolution that had taken everything from him. Old Grandma sat by her stove, comfortable with darkness, too. He knew she listened to him cry. He knew she listened to the clang of the enamel lid of the slop jar as he removed it and leaned over to vomit. In the beginning, old Grandma and Robert stayed away from him, except to say good morning or good night. The sickness and his crying overwhelmed them. Auntie had taken charge of him. In low, clear tones that Teo could hear, she warned them to be careful to make no mention of Rocky or Josiah. Teo could see what she was trying to do. When he heard Robert come in from a trip to the ranch, he sat up on the bed and called him.
The bay mare had her colt,